Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Holly Rubenstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Today, I'm joined by one of the world's leading travel authors and journalists, Sophie Roberts. Formerly the editor-at-large of Condé Nast Traveler and Departures magazine, as well as a columnist at the Financial Times, Sophie's focus now is primarily on remote parts of the world, reporting on fragile cultures, wildlife conservation, and threats to ecosystems. And she's just released her first book, The Lost Pianos of Siberia, which we'll come onto later. I hope this episode grabs you and transports you to the wild and wonderful ends of our planet. It's a long-haul, feature-length episode and a love letter to travel, which will take you to some truly far-flung locations, from deepest Siberia and wild Papua New Guinea to the deserts of Chad and the lakes of Kashmir. I really hope that you enjoy it as much as I did. Here's Sophie Roberts. Sophie Roberts, welcome to the Travel Diaries. How are you?
I am feeling pretty good, actually. It's fantastic to be here with you.
I caught you in a rare moment when you're actually here in the UK.
Yes, I've obviously got a slight issue with staying still. and I've just come back from Uzbekistan.
Oh, wow.
Which was really exciting, actually. I last went there 20 years ago. And to see how much a country can change in such a short period of time is kind of, you know, it's one of the great rushes of travel, actually.
So is it really opening up to tourism?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you know, the politics have changed and ish, and the agenda has changed hugely. And there, what used to be a pretty closed state is now welcoming the money that comes from tourism with open arms. Mm. So the threat as a visitor is actually issues of over-tourism rather than... Yeah. Anything that more sinister than that.
Because it's so unbelievably photogenic.
It is really photogenic, and it is also one of those places that sort of sits on bucket lists. Mm-hmm. You know, the kind of poetry and the evocative power of a word like Samarkand brings people there, whatever. And mm-hmm. That now you've got direct flights from London, you have visa-free arrival. Next, in throughout 2020, they're introducing many more countries with visa-free arrival, so you can just show up and go. It's pretty extraordinary, and mm-hmm. it's inexpensive. I mean, it's really exciting. Over-tourism hasn't happened yet, but it's right on the edge, like so many of these fragile, exceptional places.
Mm, that's interesting. Well, we'll come more onto that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, first of all, I've been a fan of your travel writing for many years, and we'd frankly need a whole series to cover all the places that you've traveled in your life. But I'm really looking forward to hearing some of the highlights. So let's begin with chapter one, and that is your earliest childhood travel memory.
I didn't travel much as a child. My parents, we gave us a rural upbringing on the west coast of Scotland, and our playground was the big outdoors. My father was a farmer, mm-hmm. and there wasn't a whole lot of extra cash for travel either. And at the time, and still now in many ways, is, you know, it's a privilege and an expense.
Yeah.
But my first sort of really powerful memory was probably we were going to see my uncle in France, and who lived in a house in Niger, and it was incredibly exciting to me because of all the foreignness, including, I never forget, the 10 franc coin. It was like heavier and a bit thicker, and it just somehow felt so exciting to me. I mean, it's something as simple as a coin. And
yeah.
then, like, I was thinking about it, you know, an Orangina. It's all the simplest small things that stick in your head as a child.
That feel exotic.
Yeah, incredibly.
Yeah.
It was just difference. And the, you know, he lived a really romantic life on a farm in France with things that I related to it to, and things I just found. It had the house, and his life was the sort of representation of a kind of maverick soul. And I've always been drawn to that in the travel I've done ever since, I suppose. You know, mm. He had a pet pig called Hallelujah that we used to ride. We had,
wow.
He smoked some turkeys for Christmas over the chimney which rotted rather than smoked. You know, it was just fun. It was kind of mad and fun. So that was one of my earliest travel memories. And then the only other place we really went to as children was Ireland, which, of course, when my friends see the photos from that time now, they think I'm fibbing about the travel that I did back then, because the beaches in Ireland and up on the west coast of Scotland, if you get them on a blazing day of sunshine, they can look like Barbados, except there's no one on them.
Yes.
I mean, exceptional strands of whiteness. And, you know, the kids in the images of us as children sort of playing, it might seem that we're somewhere like that. In fact, more often we were playing what my mother used to call warm rain.
So tell me about the west coast of Scotland for a young child. I mean, what was it like? Tell me about the topography.
We were a bit in Argyll. My father was fish farming, so we were where there was water. And then latterly, we're in Dumfries and Galloway. And it was, you know, I remember a geography textbook when I was a child, and it said that the place where we ended up was a place called Ecclefechan in the Borders. It had the highest rainfall in the British Isles. I feel and have always felt happiest in places where there are few people.
Right.
And I didn't realise how much that meant to me until I kind of got back into my late 20s, early 30s. You know, I had a period in London, I lived in New York for a while, and something was never quite right about that city life. And something was never quite right about my early years in journalism, where I was, you know, the travel industry was kicking off. I was getting my first work. The whole concept of boutique hotels were being born. The bucket lists were hitting the cover lines of every magazine. It was all very glamorous, infinity pools, all the rest of it. To me, I was wide-eyed and excited by those ideas to begin with, but something also in me felt very hollow. It just didn't quite ever resonate with the person I really was, and hadn't understood until I got a bit older. And that was in my late 20s, early 30s. And I started to go back to those kind of wild spaces, which were, they were printed somewhere deep in my soul as a child, I think.
So that shift came in terms of where you would be looking to cover as a writer.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you can write, you're a professional, you turn your eye to the reporting that has to be done. But actually, the things that move you, that make the blood flow faster through your veins, they have a deeper, more personal resonance. And that's when I think writing is at its most convincing. It's certainly when I feel my most authentic.
Yeah.
And I started to fight for those kind of assignments and be drawn to those kind of places after I'd been through a sort of period of correction, if you like.
So going back, what got you into travel writing in the first place?
I always wanted to be a journalist, and I didn't necessarily want to be a travel journalist. I didn't sort of know it existed, to be honest. I wanted to work more in conflict journalism. But the reality is I knew there were other things that were going to matter in my life, like a family. And I also knew that I wasn't as politically motivated as some of the news reporters that were doing the kind of conflict work. I was very lucky, because when I first went for my first job, it was Condé Nast Traveler was launching in the UK, and I started off as the tea maker, but it was a real opportunity. So I sort of fell into it by accident. If I'm really truly honest, I've always thought people were more compelling than places. I've discovered that character could drive a travel narrative like nothing else. You know, these people living extraordinary lives in ordinary places, all the other way around. But the combination of the two is what really started to excite me.
Yeah.
I like interviewing.
It's the people that make the places.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah.
Completely, yeah.
So chapter two is the first place that you fell in love with. What would that be?
I fall in love incredibly easily, which is one of my problems, I think. But the first place I was obsessed with was Russia. I went there just when the Soviet Union was falling apart. It was on a school trip. It was in tourist was looking after me, and it was all heavily controlled, but also in free fall. And that I became obsessed by, everything about the Cyrillic script, everything about this kind of dark culture that had been heavily mythologized by my own Western culture. And then the actual interactions with everyday Russian people and how perception and reality can be two very different things. That really truly obsessed me and has never left me. There is something about that country that is completely unique and real. The first place I fell in love with in a more kind of upbeat, glorious days kind of way, I suppose, was India. I loved it because in simple terms, I could afford it. I could go on for days and days and days and days and adventure on a very low budget. And I liked the poetry. I liked its where it failed, where it thrived. I liked its mountains. I liked its desert. I liked its sea. It seemed to have everything.
Where did you go first? What was your first dip in that water?
I stayed in Delhi Old Town, and I just... everything about the kind of noise and the chaos and, you know, all the cliches, in fact, and, you know, E.M. Forster said it best in Passage to India, but all that chaos completely excited me. Also, as a female, as a somebody traveling alone as a female, India I felt very comfortable in, for whatever reason, but I could travel and nosy around on my own at night in a way that I felt different there than I did in other places. However wrong I may or may not have been, I felt comfortable there.
Is it somewhere you return to now?
Less so. I found what's happened with India so rapid and fast, and it's great, you know, it's a country that has developed for the benefit of many, many more Indians than it did when I was there, when it was the middle class was nothing like as affluent as it is now. But as a traveller, some of the poetry has gone for sure.
Right, because it's so overpopulated, busy.
Yes, and I, in my personal opinion, it's tourism version is a pastiche of its real soul.
I see what you mean.
So, you know, the hotels are all kind of very polished and sort of want to look like a Maharaja's palace, but aren't. You used to be able to stay in those places for $5-$10, and it might have been crumbling. It might have little rats running around in the night, but it had something that wasn't processed in $500 a night.
Well, speaking of places that you fell in love with, I wondered where you would say is perhaps the most romantic place that you've travelled.
It's funny, it would take me back to India. When I first met my husband, I met him when I was really young, and we went to Kashmir together.
Oh, wow.
And we stayed on Dal Lake for 6 weeks in a houseboat.
6 weeks?
6 weeks, yeah. It was incredible. And there was curfews running at the time. It was complete lockdown. There'd been some real trouble. But it was... I don't know, it was like the Marie Celeste. Everyone had left, and it, you know, while politically it was troubled, it was also extraordinary to be on that lake where there was no other tourists, where the boats were sinking into the lily pads, where you would just hear the kind of lonely paddle of an oarsman and no sound of motor cars, no sound of outboard motors. That was really deeply romantic.
And as a destination, it contrasts to other parts of India in a way, Kashmir, in the sense that, how would you describe its feel?
Kashmir, I mean, I've been back a couple of times since, but in those early days, it was, it was about 94, I think, by memory. It was just like this place caught in time. It's a lake cradled by mountains. It's a lake covered in lily pads. The houseboats are not just a touristic thing. You know, they have life and they have families. And it's a way of living. They do business, the market, everything on that lake. So it feels like a sort of living piece of a culture that's very different to my own. You have the sound of the mosque on one side. You have other religions, which is so defining of India's spirit, on the other. I don't know, it's just something about it that just grabbed me. Beautiful gardens, the Persian Mughal influence, and then, you know, within one of the great drives of the world is from Srinagar, the capital of Kashmir, over to Leh in Ladakh, which is truly stunning, and that's another good reason for getting up there to do that drive out.
Is that an easy thing to do as a tourist?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
I mean, Yeah, you can do it a number of ways. You can bus it. You can, you know, take an Indian ambassador car if your budget will stretch to it. You can do it on a motorbike. I've done it various different ways. I love that drive.
Oh, it's got real deep history magical to it. And very romantic.
Yeah.
So chapter three then is the place where you learnt the most about yourself.
I think probably Russia. I've been working there now for the last 2 or 3 years. I've been working in remote Siberia, Siberia being the bit of Russia that's defined by everything from the Ural Mountains all the way, in my book anyway, which is all the way to the Pacific and the Far East.
We should mention that you're about to bring out your new book, The Lost Pianos of Siberia. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing a bit more about it.
Well, it was it's an odd book. It's a curious book. It was a book that obsessed me. And essentially I spend 2-3 years looking for a piano in Siberia. And that takes me on many adventures into odd and curious and compelling places. But taking it back to your question is, what have I learned most about myself, or what taught me most about myself was that place. I learned the power of endurance, which I, and the capacity to endure, which was sometimes tough. You know, I was away from my family, sometimes up to three weeks and more. I was in extreme climates, which are not so problematic. I mean, a Siberian was the one that said it to me when she remarked that Siberia is a wardrobe problem. It's too hot in summer and too cold in winter.
Yeah.
So in other words, stop complaining, just dress right. It taught me new depths of empathy. You know, some of the human stories in that part of the world are pretty extraordinary, what these people have endured. And that, to find and dig deep to find that empathy, was something that I had to give extra space and time for. And the other thing that I learned about the act of travel is that you have to do that. You have to give it time and space. And in that part of the world, it is unbelievable. You knock on a door and you say, I'm looking for a piano. And almost every time they would welcome me there and then. It wouldn't be a case of coming back in 2 days, or let me look at my schedule, let me check out who you are. None of that. Total trust, total, deep and pure hospitality, and a sense of time having a different pace and space having a different width and height than it does in our own culture, where everything is compartmentalized into a diary slot, into a room, into a meeting. Not in that part of Russia.
How fascinating. Why were you actually looking for the piano? Tell me a bit more about this premise.
You have to read the book.
Yes, that's
why
true.
I've got 80,000 words to try and explain it. My family and I have spent a number of years in coming and going from Mongolia for other reasons.
Right.
And I became very friendly with a Mongolian concert pianist there. And she had no piano of her own. And Siberia sits just over the border. And Mongolia and Russia have a close relationship.
Yeah.
And there was this extraordinary moment in Russia's history where piano mania obsessed the country, and piano spread all the way through the old Tsarist Empire and through the Soviet period. So I go looking for an instrument on her behalf.
Fantastic. Are you musical?
No.
No, so
but music moves me.
Yeah.
I don't I'm not trained in it. Just music moves me. It always has. And it was hearing her that sort of catapulted me into doing this whole thing.
Siberia for me conjures up a pretty inhospitable environment. Can you paint a picture a little bit of the landscapes that you were traveling through in those times?
It's the scale. It's just huge. I mean, it has every landscape. You know, it's got the taiga, which is forest, which is vast, and billions of silver birch trees, which are like skinny little matchsticks. In winter, they're particularly beautiful. You know, it's silver on white, and it's never ending. And, you know, whether you're above them in a plane or you're beside them on foot, it has a sort of sense of infinity, the taiga. Then you have the steppe landscape, which is the southern landscape where it sort of borders up to Mongolia, which is dustier And it's...
For people who don't know what steppe means, how would you describe
steppe
it?
Steppe lands are arid grasslands, basically. Yeah. And they define Mongolia. They are hard to graze, so they're largely fenceless. Really, really beautiful. I mean, I particularly love Russia in the winter, which we can come back to. And then the other landscape you have is the tundra, which is permafrost. So that is ground that's frozen year-round, or meant to be, but obviously with climate change, that's changing rapidly. And that Arctic landscape is something else again. It's just, you have mountains, you have valleys that are, it's the scale of the thing. It's like Africa at its best under snow. And Africa is a place I've worked a lot, and there's a wonderful pilot that I've done a number of jobs with over the years, and he's always said to me that wherever he lands, somebody will always come out of the bush within 2 minutes. And we've had this running bet for years, and every time it's true. We think we're in the middle of nowhere and somebody will come out of the bush within 2 minutes and say hi. In Siberia, that doesn't happen. It's right. A tiny population on a huge, huge area. It's 11th of the world's landmass.
That's inconceivable.
Yeah, it's huge.
And the same with Mongolia, right? Isn't it one of the least populated countries?
It is. It's Mongolia is 4 times the size of Germany, and most of its population have now migrated into the capital, Ulaanbaatar. And it's a big fenceless landscape. There's more horses than people. So it's, maybe it's the same feeling that I'm after, constantly kind of a search for this sort of feeling of being the only one there. But Siberia's landscape is a spiritual landscape. There's a reason why shamanism had and is regaining such a stronghold in the culture.
Oh, interesting. And is that something that you participated in at all?
No. Funnily enough, I'm quite superstitious about that sort of thing. I don't know if that's the right word or I'm demeaning it by calling it superstition. But when I was in Lake Baikal, I was with my family. They came in to join me for a couple of weeks, and we were sleeping in this like $5 a night kind of cabin on the side of the lake. It was summer, and I could hear this extraordinary beat of drums, and it was a shaman ceremony that was going on further up the beach. The noise was traveling, but it was the only sound you could hear, this kind of deep thudding beat. And I was aching to go, and my interpreter said, you mustn't, because it's a ceremony for them and it's not for you, it's not for tourists. Otherwise, it'll bring some cursed bad luck on you. And of course, it was agony to me because I could hear it all night, kind of like aching to want to be part of it, but I never was.
And did you ever hear what it was that they were doing?
No, I mean, they have, I've read a lot about it. I'm interested by it. No,
because
I didn't
of course
cry.
It's almost becoming that kind of practice is being moving into the mainstream arena.
I think it's what is shamanism. It's if nature and our relationship with nature exists on a plane that we haven't yet fully understood, then yeah, I think people are trying to hold on to it, find it, connect with it again. And so we should, because we've cut those ties pretty badly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like, last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. Absolutely. Chapter 4 is your all-time favourite destination. I always think this is my favourite question to ask. Where would you pick?
My all-time favourite. It's funny, I keep coming back to that kind of Altai Himalaya region, but Nepal probably. I went there when I was 18, 19 and I fell in love with it. I again find it a relatively easy place to travel as a single woman, but there's a particular part of Nepal in the eastern Himalayas that is really dear to me, and it's this extraordinary house in the Solukhumbu, which is an area that you begin some of the Everest treks.
Right.
And Solukhumbu, there was a house there that Edmund Hillary used to stay in when he did his made his ascents, and it was dear to him. And this house it belonged to a Nepali family, and during the troubles, it was unsafe for them to stay. And this was during the Maoist rebellion. And they had to leave in a hurry. And this family left with $10,000 in a suitcase as refugees and ended up in New York. Mm. And in that period, a German friend of mine looked after that house in the belief the Maoists wouldn't touch a foreigner. And it's a house where every single wall is painted by hand, like the Buddhist Thangka paintings. It's lit by candlelight. It has a roaring fire. It is the most beautiful house. And you can see, if you walk above it, which we sometimes do in the early mornings, you walk above it, and sometimes camp, you can see Everest on a clear morning. It's quite exceptional. It's also a very holy, very sacred valley to that a particular strand of Tibetan Buddhism that's there. So it's called now, the family have come back to look after this house again. It's safe for them to be there.
So they left and now they've returned.
They've just returned.
Oh, yeah. How moving.
Yeah, it is really moving. And the sun has taken it on and he's now opening up. It used to just be sort of people, sort of friends of friends, and people that knew about it would stay. But now he's making it commercially available. It's called The Happy House, which was Edmund Hillary's name for it because it always made him happy. And it's a really, really exceptional place. So that's one of my favorites, maybe because it's got such a strong story. And the other thing that's really amazing about it is it's next door to a hospital, a very important hospital for the Solukhumbu region. You know, during the earthquake, it did amazing work. It's got a maternity unit. It's extraordinary. And this hospital is heavily supported by the Edmund Hillary Foundation and all the rest of it. And so you sort of live side by side with reality, which to me is really important. I'm not a traveler that likes things to be fenced out or for me to be fenced in.
Right. So when I am going to move on to ask you about your favorite city, do you have a favorite city or are they just not your thing?
No, I love New York. I'll always love New York. I was a student there for a year. I studied journalism in the States at Columbia, and I lived uptown on 121st or something, which was right on the edge of Harlem, and it was rocking. It was really exciting.
Yeah.
So New York I will always love, but I struggled more in London, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
Maybe because I always knew that the English and Scottish countryside was closer to get to.
So when you go back to New York now, what do you do? Where do you go? Do you have any favorite hangouts.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real kind of high-low mix. I love the glamour of New York. I mean, you know, it's fun. New York Public Library, I adore that. I will always, I mean, I think it's probably very touristy now, but there was a place called Sylvia's where I used to go on a Sunday after the gospel services up in Harlem, and it used to sell kind of southern chicken, and I don't know what it's like now, but Sylvia's, that's a cracking place.
Sticks
I love
in your
it.
Memory.
Yeah. I mean, New York, you know, it's got this incredible melting pot culture that just excites me. I feel like I'm in the whole world in one street.
Yeah, that sums it up so nicely. And you've written about some of the best hotels in the world as well. I mean, you've been to these incredible remote destinations, but also to some incredible hotels. Is there one that stands out for you?
Incredible hotels. There are so many. And they compete now at such a high level. For a number of years, I was a columnist for the FT How to Spend It magazine, and it was all hotels. So I was kind of crowded by beautiful, exceptional, very expensive, grand five-star hotels. And I think I lost perspective somehow on what makes a great hotel. Until I went to a place called Nihiwatu that sort of corrected me again. And Nihiwatu is in Sumba in Indonesia, and it is on the most exceptional beach, backed by forest. And the entire hotel was built originally as a passion project by a surfer who had discovered this amazing left-hand break. And this hotel called Nihiwatu, it's now got a new owner, it's got a lot more expensive, but something about that place just kind of thrums on a different level. It's so connected with the people in the land and the sea, and it makes me feel good when I feel tired. I went there when I was trying to finish the book to do some writing. They've got a little cottage on a bluff that has, you know, nothing, no phone, nothing. And I sat there for 2 weeks working, looking over the sea. And that is a really, from the hotel universe, that place has always excited me. I've been there 3 times now.
Sounds really restorative.
It is. And then there's another place I just recently visited for the first time, which is much closer to home, a place called Trasiera in Andalusia. And that, again, it's born of the same beginnings. You know, it's somebody who is completely passionate, who has gone out on a limb to try and stake their life in another place. And they've brought to it all the things they care about, all their ethics, all their principles. And it kind of comes out, and it's different from the corporate idea of a perfect hotel with a pillow menu. It's completely different. Mm. And Trasiera is one of those places. There are a few of them, and I think they're going to become more and more valuable. The more powerful the corporate matrix becomes, these private, personal, eccentric, maverick places, which are less obsessed by trying to hit a certain price point, trying to charge a certain cost, will become really very valuable indeed.
We talked a little bit in the past about how, as travel writers, we can become a bit disconnected with the price points of hotels and luxury hotels. When do you think it is worth forking out when it comes to travel?
As a travel writer, when I need to rest. You don't rest. It's a big mistake to think that, certainly I think it's a big mistake by my experience to think that travel writing is a one big holiday. It's really hard work.
Do you find that people ask you all the time, how was your holiday when you've been away?
I have done. I mean, they stopped on when I started doing lots of work in Siberia, but yeah, they have done. And it's really hard work. And some stories obviously more than others. And I think that there is a level of complicity between the travel journalism and the travel PR trade where the prices are kept at such a distance from us. This is not true of all publications, because some publications have a incognito a policy. You know, you're not allowed to take any freebie, you're not allowed to take any reduction, but the vast majority do, and often it's on a comp complimentary stay. And that complicity is really confusing because you don't see value anymore. And that's how the real customer sees it. And it's why I think travel writing has been hugely eroded in recent years, because people who call themselves travel writers, and myself included, have been pushed off our pegs by TripAdvisor, by everyday people taking these trips, paying for them, and actually questioning value and delivery. And that citizen journalism has become really, really powerful, and journalists have to raise their game and do more truth telling.
Yeah. Do you go to publications or the internet for your own inspiration when it comes to travel?
Well, as a journalist, I'm meant to be ahead of my competitors. You know, I'm meant to be trying to find the next thing. So I don't actually, I tend to look at what my colleagues are doing and whatnot, but I also try to define myself against them, so that I'm not trying to repeat the same stuff. There's too many people traveling for too few good reasons. And so I have to keep ahead. And so I do that by my sources are not journalists, they're travelers. And like I've said the word before, but the mavericks. Mm. So I try and sniff out the people that maybe don't have a PR or are trying to go solo or are trying to do it without the power of great big marketing, because that's when you need journalism.
Absolutely. And would you be able to let us in on any kind of tips that you see as a next big destination or a next big hotel for 2020?
I'm getting really cautious of the next big destination idea, because I was recently writing a piece for an American magazine about over tourism, and I had to really think about what I was contributing to as a journalist and creating footfall and creating attention and shining spotlights on places. And sometimes you can shine a spotlight on a place that can't handle it. It hasn't got the infrastructure. Mm. You sometimes can shine a spotlight on a place for the wrong reasons. So I'm questioning, if I'm brutally honest, I'm questioning more and more and more about why I am getting on planes and writing about places. I have to. I have to have a purpose to a flight. And while that sounds earnest, it's also really real. You know, I've got two kids that question my absence. I've got two kids that question my contribution to climate change. It's a different generation coming through. Yeah. So when you say that, ask me about what I think is going to be the next big destination, I hope it are those places that need tourism to contribute to their economy, because it's a really powerful economy, and will raise more people out of situations that doesn't otherwise have a way out. So some of the places that I'm going to be working in is Chad. I've been there before. Papua New Guinea. Really, really relevant. Tourism is powerful in these places. Mm. So those are two big ones for 2020, which are on my schedule.
Interesting. And what is it about those two countries in particular that you think will appeal to intrepid travellers, or travellers just generally?
I think that Chad is a really, really oddball, exciting destination. I've worked in the south in Zakouma, which is now, I went in pretty early when they were trying to stabilize a national park that had a really interesting population of elephants. They did that really, really successfully. The NGO African Parks, it's an incredible success story about African conservation. They put in a brilliant, brilliant little low impact lodge, and now people are going without fear of it being a kind of African badland. The north of Chad is now getting some attention. They're trying to stabilize an area up there called the Anedi, which is it's huge rock arches, it's giant canyons, it's camel trains, it's a desert. It's some of the oldest rock art in Africa. It's got so much that needs protecting, and it's got massive sense of adventure. And it's a landscape that excites me. Mm. And I think that the population is small, but the benefits from tourism could be significant. Mm. So that's a good one.
Yeah.
Papua New Guinea is bizarre. I've worked there two or three times now. And in Papua New Guinea, you can go up, as an example, the Sepik River, one of the main waterways through the country. And every 5 miles, you can encounter a different group of people who speak a different language. You can impact these communities, which are quite isolated quite significantly through gentle, soft and responsible tourism. It's hard place, and it's still working itself out with tourism. You know, there are elements which are still dangerous.
Yeah.
But there, it feels like a country that's got huge potential. I mean, the forest is divine. Divine.
Is it beautiful there?
Oh, it's divine.
Yeah.
It's divine. I mean, I took my younger son there about 2 years ago and he swam with a dugong and he came back out of the water and he said, I saw this, and he described a dugong. And
what's a dugong?
A dugong's like a sea cow.
Oh my goodness.
I mean,
like a manatee type.
Like a manatee, yeah.
Wow.
And he, you know, that was just on a little snorkel. It's kind of extraordinary. And the coral reef systems that I've seen down there are very, very healthy. And, you know,
which is so rare.
Which is so rare, so rare. And, you know, culturally, it's just, it's between the mountain people and the sea people over on the Solomon Seaside. Mm. It's you've got volcanoes. It's got kind of everything. In the logistics is still a mess trying to get between them, but it's got so much richness.
Mm, I'm sold. Chapter 5 is your hidden gem. What would that be?
My hidden gem may be obvious to some of your listeners, but I discovered it about 6 weeks ago.
6 weeks?
Yeah.
This is a very recent gem.
Yeah, and it's really small, and it's really close to where I live, because I live in the countryside in Dorset in the west of England. And it was on the north coast in Devon, and it's a place called Yeovil. Yeovil is amazing. It's like a, I think I did 3 days, 4 nights, and it's a place to recalibrate. You walk and walk and walk and walk and walk on the North Devon coast paths. The yoga, really, really good vegan food. It was totally, deeply correcting for me, having been quite exhausted at the end of a book project.
So is it a village?
No, it's a little retreat centre. I think they take about 12 people a week.
And so it's in this restorative, wild place that obviously sounds like it resembles to somewhat of a degree
modest,
your childhood.
It's quite humble. You know, it's a cottage with a sauna, and the rooms are nice, and a hot tub. And I mean, it's just really, it really works. If you're really burnt out,
yeah,
and you're not a, you know, I don't spend my life in gyms. I don't have time to do, you know, I can barely get to a hairdresser. So to be able to have 4 days to myself in a place that really made me feel well, then Yeovil is my hidden gem.
And I guess also you've spent your career uncovering hidden gems, because you travel to some of the most far-flung destinations.
Yeah, and you know what? I think it's really important to go back to something we were talking about before. I could have tried to sold Yeovil as a story and got it for free. I didn't. I really wanted to spend my own hard-earned cash on something that was going to matter, that was going to help, where I could really repair. And Yeovil did that. So it's a really genuine hidden gem. It's mm-hmm. got no, there is no complicity in that recommendation. You know, it really sorted me out. And I've recommended it to friends. I think it's about, I mean, it's not cheap. It was about £2,000, but I've recommended it to friends. You know, people like me who have to save up for that kind of thing. And it really works. And I was recommended by a friend, and I am forever grateful to it, because it was really good.
Sounds like we could all do with a few nights in Yeovil. Yeah. I certainly could. So chapter 6, in contrast, then, is the place that you'd never go back to.
I was thinking about this, and it always comes down to crowds. You know, Heathrow at Christmas, the Canary Islands, which is a really great pity, because there are Canary Islands that are further flung that are spectacular. El Hierro is spectacular, but you have to go through hell to get there. Mm. And Saint-Tropez in August, I think to spend an hour and a half in a car to move 5 miles, some of these places have gone. They've been shot out by too many people.
Mm.
I also have a funny relationship with places that have ghosts. I don't really like Mozambique. I felt that the ghosts of civil war were still quite close to the surface. Mm. So I slept badly in Mozambique.
Really? You felt it?
Yeah, you do. Yeah. 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 I mean, you do. I felt it. There's a house in Connemara in Ireland that my parents sometimes go to for the keen fishermen. You know, as I said at the beginning, my father was a fish farmer, so fishing's always been part of our lives.
And yeah.
I just could never sleep there. And then I discovered only recently that it was built near a grave of unbaptized children. You know, it's sort of, there are certain places that I think carry ghosts. Definitely, I worked in Colimar, in which is one of the gulag zones in northern Siberia and the Russian Far East. And it's just you just feel the ghosts. Mm. I think anybody would.
And the people that are still living probably carry those ghosts themselves to a degree.
Yes and no. You know, certainly you encounter people that have a different feeling and a different relationship with those places. I'm a voracious reader, and I sometimes carry the ideas with me before I've arrived. I carry too much preconception. Mm. I'm kind of conscious of that kind of ghosts in the land, if you like.
Did you feel that have you been to Rwanda?
Yes.
I've not been, but I just wondered if that would
yes,
be the
you
same
do feel
feeling.
It. Yeah. Yeah. Rwanda has so many different stories, and what sits just below the surface is sometimes hard to catch. But I went there. I went to cover the anniversary of the genocide for the Financial Times, and I was in an area called Akagera National Park, which was coming, you know, it's an incredible turnaround story again. You know, it's now got the Big Five, having been an absolute bloodbath during the genocide.
Yeah.
And I travelled through at a time when memories were very present, because it was that very week. And it was a reminder that as tourists we see a very, very polished surface most of the rest of the time, because it was so deep and profound, and something that an outsider will never touch, understand.
And is that okay as tourists?
Well, I think that these places have to be given a future.
Rwanda has certainly got kind of this huge tourism boom that is coming up now.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a tourism boom that's happening at the top end of the market. Slightly, you know, when it costs, I forget, and we need to check this, but I think it's now $1,500 US an hour for the gorillas, to be with the gorillas. It's huge.
Oh, wow.
So that's for a really certain market. Mm. You know, the lodges are getting more and more expensive. It's a tiny country, which is one of the reasons the genocide happened. You know, it's a massive pressure on the land with a large amount of people. So I'm not convinced that tourism is percolating through society at large, but the benefits to the wildlife are proven. The conservation success story is the best in Africa right now.
Right.
And the optimism that gives that country and the sense of an identity is kind of electrifying.
Mm.
But there is a gloss that should never let us forget the darkness.
Yeah, of course. Chapter 7 is your next big adventure. How many have you got probably lined up? Dozens.
So my next big adventure, I'm working with a brilliant photographer who's spent his career photographing the Arctic and disappearing ice. And it's quite logistically difficult, and it is also particularly difficult because I'm not by any means an expert in remote regions where I have to be self-supported. You know, there's a very, very big difference between the kind of travel I do, which is taking measured risk with the help of professionals, and the explorer types who go in solo and can pull themselves out of a melting Arctic Ocean.
Yeah.
But I want to spend some time in 2020 and beyond trying to understand the moral maze of traveling to the poles, and particularly up into the Arctic, where this sea ice is disappearing very, very fast, and where this great friend of mine is doing a really important piece of work. I can't quite square it yet about how I can contribute to that conversation as a writer responsibly, in view of the fact that every flight is contributing to its demise.
Yeah.
So I want to try and understand how tourism is benefiting or otherwise indigenous people that rely on the Arctic. Mm-hmm. I want to try and understand the state of wildlife and if conservation tourism is contributing or otherwise to the well-being of the Arctic. I want to try and understand if tourism should even be there.
Right.
So that is one of my big destinations for 2020, if I can work those questions out before I proceed.
That's so interesting. I mean, with our current climate emergency, we're all trying to make a change. Right? There's obviously a noticeable societal shift when it comes to travel and the issues related to it. What advice would you give as a travel expert to people who do still want to see the world, but also want to be mindful of their environmental impact?
I think it's really, really personal. And each trip you take, you have to measure it up according to your own principles. So I don't judge others on it. I can only judge myself. And for me personally, I have to be able to perceive a benefit beyond my own satisfaction in going to these places. So will it be the family with whom I stay? Will it be the publicity I'll be giving to some kind of issue or community that would benefit from that light? Is there something in it that will bring my family a wider mind or a joyful memory that is beyond simply the sybaritic, if that makes sense? Mm-hmm. You know, if it's pure indulgence for indulgence sake, I think we can do that closer to home. And to cycle back to something we were talking about earlier, when you said you were asking the hidden gem, Yeotown. Yeotown was a 2-hour drive from where I lived. I had an assignment on the cards in Bali, which probably would have given me the same sense of burnout correction. And I made the choice, and it was a really important choice, to drive 2 hours rather than fly the other side of the world to Bali.
Yeah.
And so it's those little decisions that I think, for me personally, I'm going to try and make more and more.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and travel for longer, more slowly, than be kind of in, out, one night, which I don't quite see the value of anymore. I think we have to slow things down a bit.
Yeah, I completely agree. Finally then, Sophie, we're on to chapter 8, and that's what's at the top of your bucket list. Is there anywhere left for you to uncover?
Oh, there's so many places that I have a huge, huge burn to go to. And, it's sometimes you want 10 lives, don't you, to see everything that this world has. And a lot of it is forbidden lands. I'm dying to go to Socotra, the island off the Yemen, which is pretty fiendishly difficult to get to, but it has an extraordinary ecosystem and some of the world's best diving, and it's a sort of forgotten land, really. Those sort of places excite me. But on a more accessible level, I really want to travel the Mississippi. Ooh. I really want to travel the Mississippi.
On a slow boat?
On a really slow boat. The friend, a photographer friend who is keen on doing that journey with me, thought we should do it without any kind of power. So I think it means to float down the Mississippi, which might take a while. But I want to understand America.
Yeah.
My grandmother was an American. I studied there, and I have, lived in New York for a bit. And a lot of my work and journalism is published in America, so I've kind of got connections with it. But I have never understood beyond Manhattan, and that is a bit of a shocker. So I want to get out and take time, and I think my kids are interested in it. Some good long road trips, river trips, however it comes.
Sounds wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Sophie. Those were your travel diaries. It's been such a pleasure.
Thank you.
Wow, that was Sophie Roberts. What a life she has led so far. Such a love for wild spaces and some food for thought for all of us when it comes to travel, I think. All the destinations mentioned by Sophie I've included in this episode's show notes, and her new book, The Lost Pianos of Siberia, is out now. If you liked this episode, why not subscribe and get new episodes weekly? You can do that for free on all the podcast apps like Apple, Spotify, and Castbox. And to find out who's on next week's show, come and find me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening, and I look forward to speaking to you again next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
How's it? My name is Les Eddy. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come on, let me show you something. Oh, careful. Can you see it? Oh, trust me. It can see you. There, between the trees. It's not every day you get to see a rhino on a walk. I guess not everyone is taken to the right places, but you will be if you explore. For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com and don't just travel. Explore.